Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Meredith Miller-Vostries, and it is my pleasure to introduce Joshua Kendall, author of First Dance, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama. Joshua Kendall is an associate fellow at Yale University's Trumbull College. He is an award-winning journalist and author whose work has been published in the Wall Street Journal, Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, Business Week, and Psychology Today. For his excellence in reporting, Joshua has received national journalism awards from the National Mental Health Association and the American Psychoanalytic Association. Joshua Kendall received his bachelor's from Yale University and did graduate work in comparative literature at Johns Hopkins University. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming author Joshua Kendall.
Thanks so much, Meredith. It's a pleasure to be here in California. We all learn about the presidents as school children, and when we first encounter the presidents, we think of them as statues, those folks on Mount Rushmore. And then later, maybe when we take American history course in college, we start to realize that maybe these guys aren't demigods, as we might think. And in this book, I'm using fathering as a way in to talk about presidential character. And I really want to capture the complexity of presidents. And I want to do that by looking at how they fathered their children. And I want to give readers a feel for what it was like to have dinner with Franklin Roosevelt or to spend a weekend with Lyndon Johnson. And when we think of presidents, we tend to think of a list of policies. And I want to encourage readers to think about the human beings behind those policies and also about their decision-making process. As James David Barber, an influential political scientist, put it in the 1970s in his book on presidential characters, the issues will change, but the character of the president will last. Now, information about presidential families, there really isn't a lot out there. And one reason is about that the families themselves have tried to prevent historians from doing digging. For instance, some of the letters of the children of John Adams aren't in the Massachusetts Historical Society. One of his children died at about 30, and some important letters in Charles Adams's life aren't available. And also, historians have ignored presidential families. Historians tend to focus on policy, and they think, well, how a president interacted with his kids, that's just squishy stuff. And I'm going to emphasize that it's not squishy stuff, but that this material is woven into the fabric of American history. And let me just give you one example. The 2016 presidential race has already been affected by the grief of one candidate over the loss of a child. In the fall, I wrote a piece for the New York Times about Joe Biden and about why Joe Biden decided not to run this year. And presidential grief has, one of my chapters in my book is about presidents who have lost children. And one horrifying but touching example is of Franklin Pierce. He was elected president in 1852. He was a dashing senator from New Hampshire, a great speaker. 2 months before his inauguration in January of 1853, he takes a train from the Boston area back to New Hampshire with his third and only surviving son on the train. There's an accident, and his son's head gets split open. And Pierce has to pick up his son, who has a hole in his head, and the son is dead. Then he has to go take on the presidency. A week later, he writes to his friend Jefferson Davis, the future Confederate president, who's about to become his Secretary of War, and says, I'm not sure I can go on. And for the next 4 years, he has some kind of post-traumatic stress disorder, and he's barely able to handle his duties. His wife literally goes psychotic and starts writing letters to her dead children. And another example of a president whose grief played a huge role in American history is Calvin Coolidge. In 1924, Coolidge is about to run for a term of his own. His 16-year-old son, Cal Jr., cuts his toe on the tennis court A week later, he drops dead. It's a septic wound. Today, it would be treated in an hour. Then they weren't sure what to do. 9 years later, when Coolidge dies, Dorothy Parker of The New Yorker says, how could they tell? The reason for that is that he began sleeping 11 hours a day, taking these long afternoon naps, and he was really out of it. And as I argue in my book, his depression about the loss of his son may well have helped to cause the Great Depression. He was kind of asleep at the switch. So those are just two examples of how presidents interact with their families. Their fathering experiences are critical to the fabric of American history. A little bit about my method. I take the long view. It's nonpartisan. Some Republican presidents were lousy fathers. Some Republican presidents were great fathers. Some Democratic presidents were lousy. It's not my idea. It's not my goal to sort of have a partisan agenda, but just to try to capture the complexity of these men. Or so far, we've had 43 presidents. 38 have had biological kids, and the others adopted kids. So we can really say something about every president based on his interactions with children, and including George Washington. Now, George Washington didn't have any biological children, but Martha had children from her first marriage. And again, this is another instance where you can see how fathering experiences are related to the course of American history. One of the reasons George Washington was unanimously elected our first president is that he had no biological children. If you go back to the 1780s, we had just kicked the Brits out of our face, and the last thing we wanted to do was set up another monarchy. And George Washington was kind of a safe candidate because he wasn't going to pass on the reins of power to a family member. And remember, dynasties came up again in this election in 2016, and Americans really don't like dynasties. And that was something in George Washington's favor. All right, I divide the presidents into six buckets, and the news isn't good. As the USA Today said in its review of my book, father knows best except when he's president. The largest category is preoccupied dad. These are dads who are thinking about politics all the time. As Lyndon Johnson said, I think about politics only 18 hours a day. His daughter, Linda, who wanted FaceTime with him, figured out that the best way to get some was to read the congressional record. Most teenagers wouldn't go near it. She went near it so her father would talk to her. He couldn't say, how was your day? That's too relational. But he could talk to her about pending legislation. So the other categories are playful. About 40% fit in the preoccupied. Other categories are playful, double dealing. Those are dads with illegitimate children. Remember the election of 1884 was Grover Cleveland. It came out before that election that Grover Cleveland had fathered a child out of wedlock. It was sort of a national referendum on that issue. He acknowledged it, and Americans sided with him over James Blaine, and there's some other presidents who had illegitimate children, a few of whom are well-known, and a few surprises in the book. Another category is tiger dads. You may remember that book by Amy Chua about the tiger moms. Tiger dads are very, very strict. John Adams was a tiger dad. He told his eldest son, John Quincy Adams, you're either going to be president or you're going to be a failure. John Quincy rose to the challenge and became quite a mover and shaker. He was an excellent Secretary of State and later president. John Quincy was also a tiger dad. He had a couple of kids at Harvard. One was 30th in his class out of 75, and John Quincy says, no Christmas vacation at home for you. You got to stay in Cambridge and keep studying. And then he sort of shifted the goalposts. When the kid is about 15th in his class, he says, I'm not going to come to graduation unless you're in the top five. So he was a tiger dad. Then I've the grief-stricken, whom I've talked about. I've given you an example of Pearson Coolidge. And then the nurturing dads, the sweet ones. Rutherford B. Hayes, Harry Truman, and Barack Obama are examples. Margaret Truman described herself as a total daddy's girl. And in the 1940s, she wanted to become a singer. Bess Truman was a typical mother of the era and said, "This is 1940s America. None of this career stuff for you, my girl. You got to go get married." And Harry said, "She wants to become a warbler. Let her become a warbler." Very, very sweet. And the current president, Barack Obama, is also a nurturing dad. And whatever one thinks about his policies, most Americans are very proud by how much interest and time he eats dinner with his girls five nights a week. That he's really, and some people have actually criticized him for being too nurturing. I spoke with Susan Eisenhower for the book, Ike's Granddaughter, and she said, "The presidency is like a combat zone. Maybe he has to tell his girls, sorry, for the next couple of years, I got to check out and deal with ISIS or whatever else is on his plate." And these are kind of heart-wrenching decisions that all presidents have, but Barack Obama is also characterologically suited to being a father. He really enjoys it, but it's very hard to do when you're president, and it brings up all kinds of complicated issues about responsibility. So in the book, I have three stars in each chapter. And so, for instance, for the preoccupied, I talk about Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson, and Jimmy Carter. So there are six chapters, so I profile 18 presidents in depth. But then I try to say a little bit about every president, and some presidents fall in more than one category. For instance, George Herbert Walker Bush was a preoccupied dad. He raised his family in Houston, and he often went back to Connecticut on business, and he left the kids with family members or friends. And Jeb Bush once said, "At least they didn't put us in a kennel." But George Herbert Walker Bush was also a grieving dad. He lost a daughter, Robin, in the 1950s, his second child. And he kept her at the age of about four. He kept her portrait on his desk. It's in Houston on his desk to this day. And 50 years later, he couldn't talk about it. He had difficulty talking to a New York Times reporter with whom I spoke about this loss. And also, what's interesting about that loss is that that also created a playful pal. So the second category, where there was preoccupied and then playful, George W. Bush was playful with his two daughters. And that starts in the 1950s. Barbara Bush's hair turns white after the loss of Robin. And George W. Bush starts becoming very clownish in an attempt to cheer up his mother. And that became a core part of his personality, and that's the way he interacted with his two daughters, Barbara and Jenna. So a little bit more about the preoccupied dads. I guess that would include Herbert Hoover here in Palo Alto. When Herbert Hoover was Secretary of Commerce in the 1920s, his two sons were living here in Palo Alto and going to high school. And Hoover was kind of an absentee dad, and he would learn about his kids through updates from paid caregivers. So he was kind of a distant dad. And then one of his sons had tuberculosis during his presidency, and he managed just one visit. His son was in his late 20s. So Hoover's kind of typical of presidents of being focusing on politics and policy all the time. Jimmy Carter is an interesting case. We all think of Amy Carter when we think of Jimmy. Those of us who are alive in the 70s remember Amy. But many of us don't know that Jimmy Carter had three sons before Amy. They were all about 15 years older than Amy. And these three sons were all married, and so he had a kind of built-in staff of campaign staff of six. Jimmy Carter was on What's My Line in 1974, when he was finishing up his term as governor, and no one knew who he was, but his staff of six helped him become president. But he was very, very tough with his three sons. Jimmy Carter was in the Naval Academy, and he kind of bossed his sons around a lot, was very strict. I spoke with Chip Carter, who said that Jimmy had a philosophy of spanking. And in the 1980s, after his presidency, one of the sons came up to Carter and said, "Dad, you've ruined my life with your harsh parenting. And Jimmy Carter was totally flummoxed by that comment. But then he began to take his son seriously. And I found that very moving, that he realized that he had been a bit out of touch. And he made amends with his eldest son, Jack. So when I was in Atlanta, I signed a book for Jimmy Carter. And I signed it to America's best post-president and best post-presidential dad, because I was very moved by how he had realized that his own father was extremely strict and he was so busy building his career as a farmer and as a politician that he really didn't think through how he wanted to father his children. And then when his son hit him with that, he ended up doing some soul searching and realized that he'd been kind of stuck in a rut. So I found that very moving about Jimmy Carter. All right, The Playful Pals, my three stars for that chapter are Ulysses S. Grant, Teddy Roosevelt, and Woodrow Wilson. Teddy Roosevelt used to go into the attic, used to work until 3 o'clock, and then go play tag in the attic with his sons. Woodrow Wilson loved to dance. He had three girls. We think of him as very austere, but he had three girls, and a different side of him came out. And he used to love to dance with his girls. And if you think about the old Freudian line that a girls always kind of marry their father, one of the girls ended up marrying the best dancer in Washington, who happened to be his secretary of Treasury, William McAdoo, who was an older man. So it was kind of like she found in him, she refound her father. And Ulysses S. Grant was also very sweet, loved to play with his kids. And we think of him as a very tough general, but his daughter Nellie gets married during his administration. And right after the wedding, Grant goes into her bedroom and starts crying his eyes out. So a different side of Grant comes out if you look at his parenting. All right, The Double Dealing Dads with Illegitimate Children. The three stars of that chapter are John Tyler, Grover Cleveland, and Warren Harding. Thomas Jefferson also qualifies, but so much has been written about Jefferson and his slave children that I didn't feel it was necessary to add much. Grover Cleveland, I've already mentioned. John Tyler, there's quite a bit of circumstantial evidence suggesting that he had dozens of slave children. And in the book, I lay out the case for that. And my conclusion is that the Tyler research is kind of where the Jefferson research was a generation ago. There's since been DNA evidence for Jefferson. There's not yet DNA evidence for Tyler, but there's quite a bit of circumstantial evidence. And there are also newspaper reports in the 1840s. So Tyler was elected with William Henry Harrison. Harrison had 10, it's the ticket, the most fertile ticket. Harrison had 10 children with his wife. Tyler had 8 children with his first wife, 7 children with his second wife, and both of them apparently had slave children. There's a historian who argued that Harrison had 4 slave children, and Tyler, the count is in the dozens, and there were newspaper reports back in the 1840s that he sold a few of his slave children. So I argue that he's a double-dealing dad, and there were 5 presidents alive at the start of the Civil War, and Tyler was the only one to side with the Confederacy. And when he dies in 1862, Lincoln refuses to acknowledge his death. My argument is that there's some evidence that he betrayed his children and betrayed his country. In contrast, Cleveland was a double-dealing dad who admitted it, but he was quite an honest president. You might not trust him with your daughter, but you could trust him with the budget. And that's part of my argument, that these are complicated people, and sometimes the dad is like the president, and sometimes the private and the public are very different. And I also have evidence that Lyndon Johnson fathered a child out of wedlock. Johnson used to brag to his staff that I had more women by accident than Kennedy had by design. And there's a woman who wrote a memoir that includes some canceled checks suggesting that he fathered a child with her, and I find her case persuasive. And there's another loyal aide for Johnson who said that when she first got to work, he offered to set her up in an apartment in New York if she would have his child, an offer she politely declined. All right. The Tiger Dads, I mentioned John Adams and John Quincy Adams. Another Tiger Dad is Dwight Eisenhower. And I found out that Dwight Eisenhower had two sons, one son, Ikey, who died at the age of three in the 1920s, and so he was grief-stricken by that loss. But he also had another son, John. And John Eisenhower happens to graduate from West Point on June 6th, 1944. So as an author, I found that impossible to resist. So I have a scene in my book where John's about to receive his diploma. And right after the graduation, John is shipped to his father in on the front. And they spend a month together. He hasn't seen his father in about 2 years, and Ike is really excited to see him. But Ike is in full Tiger Dad mode, and he criticizes John every which way. They play bridge together, and his bridge game is lousy. They take a Jeep, and some dust gets flicked onto John's uniform, and Ike is up in arms about that. He was very, very tough. But Tiger Dads can either make or break a child. John Adams, as I suggested, kind of made John Quincy Adams by being so tough, but he has two other children who kind of self-destruct and become alcoholics. But John Eisenhower ends up doing very well. He becomes an eminent military historian, and he retires as a general, and he works with his father on his father's memoirs and then writes books of his own. Ike had a bad temper, and John works as an aide in the late 50s, and Ike kind of spills out some of his anger on John. And Ike also, in the White House, is angry with his aides a lot. And then after he has a little outburst, he tells them, well, my mother taught me how to control my temper. And then as soon as he's out of the room, the aides say, she didn't do a very good job. All right, the grief-stricken, I mentioned Pierce and Coolidge. Another example is McKinley. McKinley loses two daughters before the age of four, but grief as can also kind of make or break a president. So I argued that with Pierce and Coolidge, the grief really devastated them. But with McKinley, he loses two children, and it gives him a sense of purpose. And that's what motivates him to go into politics. And that's kind of his brand, this very dedicated family man. His wife has a stroke, and he and his wife are very connected by these two devastating losses. And he rebounds. Another example of a president who experienced what psychologists call post-traumatic growth after his grief is Abraham Lincoln. In 1862, Abraham Lincoln loses his son, Willie. And one of the first people he hears from is Franklin Pierce, former president, writes, Lincoln, I know exactly what you're going through. But as opposed to Pierce, Lincoln kind of taps into some kind of heroic part of himself and really pulls himself together and is able to carry on with the war. And it kind of energizes him in a kind of weird way, giving him a sense of mission. So sometimes grief can help people tap into their heroic sides. And I think that's what happens with McKinley and with Lincoln. And another example of presidential grief is JFK. JFK, a couple of months before he dies, gets assassinated. A child dies one day old. And JFK, who had been kind of cheating on his wife a lot, and he had a very tense family life, then is kind of bowled over by this loss. That day, he goes into a closet in Massachusetts General after holding his son's hand and just starts bawling. And he and his wife actually became much closer during the last couple of months of his life due to that loss, and it makes his loss, his death, even sadder because it sounded like that loss was bringing out parts of him that had kind of been buried, his concern for his family. So he was also a grief-stricken dad. So I want to end on an up note and talk about some of the sweeter dads. Rutherford B. Hayes He's the dad, had five children, and he was just, in his letters, his daughter starts using a certain word, and he comments about how her language is different at age 3 and age 4, and he enjoys holding birthday parties for her. Just very, very sweet. And he's also the dad behind the Easter egg roll at the White House. That's the biggest event every year at the White House. About 30,000 kids use the president's lawn, and it starts in 1878. He's walking outside the White House, and a street urchin comes up to him and says, "Sir, can we roll our eggs on your lawn?" And he says, "Well, let me think about it." And he gets back to the kid and says, "You know, let's do it." Just a very sweet and nurturing person. Obama, I've talked a little bit about, and Harry Truman. Remember in 1950, Margaret does become a warbler. And in 1950, she gives a concert at Constitution Hall, and she gets fiercely attacked by a Washington Post music critic. Harry gets up the next morning early and writes a letter to the editor, writes a letter to the music critic saying, "I'm going to bust your chops." And the letter is eventually published, not in exactly how it was written, but most of it's published. And his aides are saying, "Oh, Mr. President, you know, this is a public relations disaster. You have to control your anger." But he says, "Let's look at the mail." And the mail is actually 80-20 in favor. And Margaret says, "I'm glad chivalry isn't dead." And I just want to end by connecting, because I try to connect parenting to politics and to policy. And if you step back and think about Truman for a minute, the most consequential decision he made as president was in August of 1945, when he's got to decide whether or not to use the atom bomb. And I believe that the same calculus went into that decision that went into the decision to write the letter to the editor of the letter to the editor about the Washington Post music critic, and that Truman wasn't a violent man, he wasn't a nasty man, he wasn't a warmonger, but he decides to use the atom bomb because he wants to protect America's children, young men. And the generals were telling him that if the war went on without a bomb, another 200,000 American soldiers would be killed. So I think with his daughter, the sense was, look, if you mess with my daughter, I'm going to come after you. And I think the same with the Japanese. If you're going to threaten a couple of 100,000 of my boys, I have no choice but to come after you. So that's really what I'm trying to get readers to think about, is who are these people, how do they make decisions, and what kind of character do they have? And I think that's something I want readers to think about, both about past presidents and about future presidents, especially that this is an election year. Okay, so I'll stop now and we'll go to the questions.
Thank you so much, Joshua. It's great to hear the stories. The book is full of insights, and it's clear that you've done a tremendous amount of research, and your journalism career, you know, bears a lot on this. I'm wondering, given all the research that you've done, why should we care about presidential parenting styles?
As I said, I think it's a way into character, and I think there's a tendency with presidents to either think of them as great or bad, and just to see how complicated they are, and that, you know, sometimes, so maybe like there's been a big debate, you know, about if a president had an affair, then he must be like tainted or something, but just to see the complexity, and maybe that, you know, that's, we don't have to approve of that, but maybe there are other things that are really admirable, and so I think parenting is just a way into character, which is something that we need to consider both about presidents past and about presidents future, and also in our own lives, a way in to think about our own parents, mm-hmm. and a lot of us are parents, and think about how we're relating to our children.
Right, and you do in the beginning of the book state that character counts as and is a critical variable in political analysis. So you ask this yourself in one of your magazine articles, does a good father make a good president? Are there parallels that can be drawn?
Yes. I think a good father can be a steady president, but I think our best presidents have not been great fathers. just to take two, Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, you know, maybe the best Democrat of the 20th century and the best Republican, both of them were very inspiring leaders. Both of them could really connect with anonymous millions. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt gets us through the Great Depression, gets us through the Nazis, gets us through the Japanese. Ronald Reagan makes Americans feel proud again. But neither man could really connect with his own children. Franklin Roosevelt's children had to make appointments to see him. And one child wanted to tell his father that he was going to get married. And Roosevelt shoves a document in his face and says, "What do you think about this document?" The poor boy is humiliated and goes back to Eleanor and says, "I'm never going to talk about anything serious with him again." And Ronald Reagan, again, also very inspiring, but this came out after Nancy Reagan's recent death, that he and Nancy had a wonderful bond, but that wonderful bond seemed to exclude the children. The children often felt neglected. And they felt like the man on the street felt like he or she could connect with Reagan, but his two children with Nancy, Patty and Ron, often felt alienated. And in the 1980s, Patty wrote a novel criticizing her father, and there was just a lot of family tension. But so, like, when Franklin Roosevelt dies in 1945, most Americans felt as if they had lost a father, but his own children never felt as connected as they had wanted to be with their father.
And while we're looking back, you can guess that a lot of our audience is looking forward towards the election year cycle. And we have a lot of questions from you asking about our presidential contenders. And they would like your insights on their parenting styles, what you know about Trump, Clinton, Sanders,
yep,
and what we as voters may take away from that information.
Yeah, I have interviewed one of the Trump children, Eric, and I think this election, as I argue in a piece I wrote for Parade, and this election is kind of a turn away from Obama. Obama is a sweet parent, and he's a connector, and I think Americans like the fact that he is so loyal to his daughters, but I think Americans want more of a mover and shaker. And I think Americans are a little bit frustrated with Obama. They want him to do more. They maybe want him to be a little bit more like LBJ, who wasn't having dinner with his daughters, but was twisting arms. And I think in both Trump and Clinton and Sanders, you see dynamos, people who sort of promise action, whereas Obama wants everyone to get along. And that was the same with Harry Truman. Harry Truman was criticized for many of the same things that Obama has been criticized for, about wanting to get along, see all sides of a question. And when Harry Truman left office in 1952, his popularity was only 20% favorable ratings. And most Americans thought he was a total failure. But in hindsight, David McCullough wrote a biography, and there's been a kind of his reputation has come back. And I think with nurturing dads, I think Americans really appreciate the fundamental decency, but they get frustrated because they want them to do more. And I think both Trump and Clinton are I think they're both preoccupied, as even though Clinton would be the first mother. As a parent, she's a preoccupied parent. Chelsea has been on the campaign trail since about the age of two. And when Chelsea was six, Bill Clinton was running for governor, and he was being slimed by the Republicans. And Bill and Hillary sat Chelsea down at age six and decided to talk to her about all of these insults. And Chelsea started crying. And it just shows. And you know, a lot of parents would say, "Well, it's a six-year-old; let's leave her out of it." But they felt that politics is so central to them that they needed to. And I think that's maybe a sign of preoccupation with the Trumps. And Chelsea connects with her parents through work. Remember, like LBJ's mm-hmm. daughter, and so do the Trumps. Donald Trump has three children from his first marriage, and they're all, you know, vice presidents of the Trump Organization, just like Chelsea Clinton is a vice chairwoman of the Clinton Foundation. So I think this election, we're, and I think preoccupied parents have been our best presidents, but they've also, they're a bigger risk, because some preoccupied parents, maybe like Herbert Hoover from here in Palo Alto, he was working all the time, but he really couldn't connect with the American people, just as he couldn't connect with his children. So they're kind of a bigger risk. Sometimes they achieve great things, like, you know, Reagan and the end of communism, or FDR and the end of World War II, but sometimes they're just in their own little world and can't relate to the average person, just as they can't relate to their children. But I think there's a frustration in America with Obama that he hasn't twisted more arms and gotten more things done. And that's where I think we are in this election cycle.
So we'll leave it up to the voters to decide how to infer all that and play it out in the ballot box. How have you seen some of the questions asked about first dads' parenting styles, how it has affected their children's parenting styles? I know Chelsea Clinton has a toddler, maybe premature. Someone specifically asked about JFK. Was he influenced by his father? How may his being a first dad and parenting styles affected his children? If you could talk a little bit about how it affects the generations and their parenting.
Yeah, so parenting is often passed down from generations, but sometimes in confusing ways. For instance, I talk about my nurturing dads, Rutherford B. Hayes and Obama. Rutherford B. Hayes never knew his father. His father died before he was born, and Obama hardly knew his father, the fellow from Kenya, he sees for about 2 months during his life. So both Rutherford, but everyone tends to parent as they have been parented. So Rutherford B. Hayes and Obama father as they were mothered. And maybe that's why they're kind of nurturing. And another interesting example is George Washington. So the past is always there. Sometimes it's just a replication of the past. John Adams was very tough. John Quincy Adams was very tough. But sometimes it's the opposite of the past. George Washington had a very critical mother who used to embarrass him during the Revolution. I mean, he was busy fighting the British, and she would make known from Virginia that her son was neglecting her and spread nasty rumors about him. And she was really awful. And when he becomes a step-parent, he says, I'm not going to be like her. And his mother taught him how not to parent. And he was actually quite sweet. And I classify him as a nurturing dad with his stepchildren and step-grandchildren. So the past is always there, but oftentimes it's just repeated mechanically, sometimes for the good, maybe with Hayes and Obama, and sometimes maybe for the bad with a tiger dad. But sometimes people can intervene, but it has to be, they have to put a lot of energy into it to say, oh my God, my mom was not so hot and I'm going to change. But I think that's something we all can relate to with our own children. And maybe I'm hoping in this book we'll get people to think about their style and where it comes from, and to give people more choices in life.
Is there a particular child that you interviewed or story that you captured that you particularly identified with?
Yes. My father was kind of a tiger dad, and I related to John Eisenhower. He became a writer, and his father kind of, you know, his father was loving but also could be very critical. And I related a lot to John Eisenhower, and he lived a long life, and but he had a few bumps along the road in dealing with his father.
And I know you have a background in looking at some of the psychoanalysis of some of the historical figures that you've covered. People want to know, how did you get the idea for this topic?
Yeah, for my last.
Where did this come from?
I wrote a book before this called America's Obsessives, about seven American icons who were control freaks who became extremely successful. It starts with Thomas Jefferson and ends with Steve Jobs. And when I did Jefferson, Jefferson was a visionary thinker, and he was an amazing president. People forget that in the election of 1804, he was reelected by about 75% of the vote. He was very popular, great political leader. But as a parent, he was a bit scary. I mean, he would tell his daughters what to wear, what to do. He was a control freak, give them lists and schedule their day. And it just brought up this whole question of how do you lead a country and how do you lead a family? And that's what I, and that was sort of the guiding question that got me started.
So all of us struggle with that work-life balance. Do you have some magical advice that you culled from this for us?
Well, as I say, presidents are we all have that challenge, and for presidents, it's even harder because, you know, most of us, our responsibility, you know, we're not responsible for 300 million people, much less the whole world. So their choices are really grueling. But I guess maybe what comes out is what I've just been talking about is the importance for reflection and sort of trying to acknowledge, okay, what was my experience and what kind of parent do I want to be? And to really listen, and because I feel like a lot of people go on automatic pilot, and some people are fortunate if they had a really great parent, automatic pilot is going to be good, but sometimes it's not going to be so good. And I think reflection to give people more choices, I think it's very important.
And while you say that you don't want to dwell on it, it's clear that there are a disproportionate number of presidential children who had tragedies.
Yes.
And had troubled lives. As someone says here, they became alcoholics or had tragic ends, suffered from mental illness.
Yes.
So do you think this is more so than with children of successful celebrity parents or with other fields? This also rings true. I mean, in Silicon Valley, as parents, we're very concerned about the stress of our teens. With academic pressure and high expectations, the tiger dad, the tiger mom is certainly something that is a community discussion here in Silicon Valley. And I'm curious to know what you saw with presidential teens.
Yes, because presidents, Michael Beschloss, the historian, has talked about the curse of the famous scion that, you know, especially in the 19th century, there are just so many cases. Sometimes it's just bad luck, like with Franklin Pierce's son and the accident, but sometimes it's family pressure, and John Tyler, he had a son, John Jr., who becomes alcoholic, and then he has to suffer the indignity of becoming a petty bureaucrat for Ulysses S. Grant. So this is a former Southerner who has to work in the Grant administration, so what could be more humiliating than that? And then he dies in his 70s. He has alcoholism, just a very sad life, and one of the obituary writers, you know, how horrible to live a life so useless. I mean, there are just a lot of examples in the 19th century. And I think presidents, going back to the preoccupied, it's a self-selected group of very, very ambitious people. And their focus is not, you know, on their children and giving guidance to their children. Fortunately, in the last 50 years, presidential children seem to be doing a lot better. You know, the Bush girls, now young women, or George W. Bush's daughters, Chelsea Clinton is doing well. The last half century, they've done a lot better. But in the 19th century, it's hard to find examples. I guess it's hard to find examples of presidential sons who did well. One example is Robert Lincoln. I guess just on the side, one of my most exciting research finds when I was at Harvard, I found a letter that Robert Lincoln went to Harvard, like Malia Obama. Harvard seems to be the place of destination for first children. Robert Lincoln goes to Harvard, and in 1862, he's a sophomore, and the president of Harvard has to write the president of the United States that Robert is failing chemistry. And after that, Robert has other problems. He's caught smoking at Harvard Square. And Lincoln was kind of an absentee dad for Robert. But Robert ends up doing very well. He becomes a Secretary of War, and he makes a lot of money, becomes very wealthy by heading the Pullman Car Company. And one of Rutherford B. Hayes' sons does very well. Webb Hayes helps to found Union Carbide. But there are really not that many examples of presidential children who do well in the 19th century. In the 20th century, you have more. You have Robert Taft, the son of William Howard Taft. William Howard Taft was a preoccupied dad. Poor Robert would play chess by himself as a child. He was kind of lonely. But he's an incredible intellect. He's first in his class at Yale and at Harvard Law School, and he's presidential timber in the 1940s and 50s. So there are more examples, but it used to be this kind of curse to be a first child. But it has changed in the last 150 years.
That's good to hear for those that are coming. Yeah. And speaking of more recently, it does seem that some of the presidential children are following in their first dad's footsteps or being influenced by their work. You mentioned Chelsea Clinton. She does work with the Clinton Foundation. The Bush women are also involved in some social services. And then we have the political dynasty between fathers and sons with the Bushes.
Right.
People are curious about fathers following in their sons following in their father's footsteps. Can you walk us through a little bit of the dynastic feel of that?
Yeah, as I said, Americans really don't like dynasty, so it's hard. I mean, Jeb Bush tried to follow in his father's footsteps, and the Americans rejected him. It's very challenging. But I think having a president who's having a father who's a president, it's just a huge imprint, you know, on the child, and it does. It's hard not for that experience not to fuel a fire at some point or other. In the cases that we've just talked about.
Mm-hmm. And with the current president, were you surprised, or did it follow suit with your research that Malia Obama is taking a gap year? That was big news in Silicon Valley, taking time off from your academic progression. So I was curious to know if that took you by surprise or it's expected.
I think the reason for that was that this way, when she goes to Harvard, she'll no longer be a president's child and she won't have to have the Secret Service. And I think it's a way to get out of the spotlight. But I did write a piece for Politico about Harvard that there are 22 other presidential children who went to Harvard, and it's by far the highest tally of any university. Yale and Cornell come in a distant second with about 7 or 8. So it just seems like, but the other presidential children who went to Harvard were the Roosevelts, I mean, all Theodore Roosevelt's children, Franklin Roosevelt's, Carolyn Kennedy. But it does seem, and what's interesting is that the presidents, about 7 or 8 presidents have gone to Harvard, and when the presidents go to Harvard, they often do amazing things. Obama was president of the Harvard Law Review. JFK published his senior thesis. That was his first book. But the sons, the children, or until recently the sons, because Harvard didn't accept women until recently, the sons' careers are not so great. Franklin Roosevelt's son flunked out. He had problem passing German, but Malia Obama.
Some gender analysis here.
Yeah, but Malia Obama has, if she does well at Harvard and she graduates, the bar isn't very high that the other presidential children kind of stumbled a lot in their academic careers.
And a lot of times presidential children are kept out of the limelight, whether they're successful or they're stumbling. How did you get access to all of this information? So often the children are shielded from public view. You have a wealth of information here.
Yeah, as I said, that the families have tried to keep keep their children away from people like me, both when it comes to archives and when it comes to interviews. But I did, you know, there is quite a bit in the archives about the children, and I was able to interview for 20th century presidents a lot of the grandchildren. It was exciting to interview about 5 of Franklin Roosevelt's grandchildren, including Ellie Seagraves, who was about 5 years old when FDR took the oath of office. And then I spoke to Harry Truman's grandson, and he told me a funny story that, remember, Harry Truman loved to play the piano, and he gets a piano for Margaret, and Margaret takes it up, but she eventually goes into, becomes a singer, but she loves music, and Margaret gets him a piano at the same age that she got a piano, and he hated playing the piano, he said. And then I spoke to Chip, a couple of the first children. I spoke to Chip Carter, and also to Lucy Johnson. And Lucy Johnson told me that her father used to give her the famous Johnson treatment. Remember, if you've read Robert Caro's biography, you know that Johnson used to was a great manipulator of letters, and he would know exactly what to say to twist their arms to get them to support something. And he knew how to manipulate Lucy. Lucy was teaching at a Head Start, and and Johnson wants her to teach at a Head Start closer to his ranch. So he says, "What do you mean, Lucy Baines? You don't love those kids?" And he gives her a whole routine, and Lucy ends up doing. She says it's easier to do what he said, and that's probably what a lot of congressmen said over the year. But she also uses the Johnson treatment a little bit on him. She learned how to say, "Oh, you look so handsome," and give him a kiss to get her agenda. Maybe that's, you know, a little more money or something. So she practiced it back, and he fell for it.
Do you have a favorite story of a child influencing their first dad? Or something that surprised you, maybe?
Yeah, well, I guess what surprised me was how pivotal some of the children were in historical events. For instance, Theodore Roosevelt wins the Nobel Prize in 1906 for negotiating the end to the Japanese-Russian War, and he uses Alice as a key part of his strategy. He sends her on a mission to Asia, and his rebellious daughter, Alice used to say to her father, her father said, "Well, you can't smoke under my roof," and she would smoke on the roof. And he kind of uses this rebellious daughter as a diplomatic aid, and it helps him net the Nobel Prize. And just as Anna Roosevelt, FDR's eldest child, she's living at the White House in 1943, and she's the one who realizes that he has a very serious heart condition, and no one was really paying attention to it, and she may have extended his life by a couple of years. And she's also with her father at Yalta, kind of micromanaging his health and also the whole conference. So I wrote a piece for Politico about how when we elect presidents, you know, we elect a whole family, and we should, you know, check out the wives and check out the children, especially now that candidates have, you know, children in their 30s, candidates are older, and we're really electing some extra public officials there. And, you know, Bill Clinton would be a first husband. You know, he's going to be part of the package. But Chelsea and Trump has three children in their 30s who, if he's elected, could well be pivotal in some negotiation with a foreign leader.
So as a journalist, what kind of questions do you want to ask our political presidential contenders? Well, if you had an opportunity to interview them about their families or their parenting styles,
yeah, I'd want to find out more about that dinner table conversation. You know, are they really listening to their children, or is it all about politics? Mm-hmm. I'd want to be a fly on the wall during the dinners.
And if you could have dinner with anybody that you researched, who would you choose to sit down and have dinner with?
I think Teddy Roosevelt was the most most interesting person. Because he was kind of all over the place, and he was a very playful dad, but he also was very tough. I mean, his path to success was to become a war hero on San Juan Hill, and that propelled him into politics. And he, with his four sons, he wanted them all to become war heroes. And that kind of took a tragic turn when in 1918 his youngest son dies, gets killed by a German pilot. And again, he's another grief-stricken dad. And just like Joe Biden didn't run this year, Teddy Roosevelt was only about 60 when he died, and there was a lot of talk about his making a comeback in 1920. There was no, you could be president, there was no term limits then, but he was just heartbroken by the death of Quentin, and some historians have argued that he just literally died of a broken heart when his son perished in the war.
You have so many stories in here. You've clearly put in a lot of time researching this. Is there any presidential child that you didn't get a chance to cover that you would have liked more information on?
Yeah, I didn't cover some of the recent ones, Chelsea Clinton and the Bush girls. The recent, because since Jackie Kennedy in 1960, she was the one who really tried to put a wall around, because her children were very young, and she really tried to put a wall around the children. And in the last, I mean, Theodore Roosevelt's children, were much more you know, we're much better known, but there's just kind of a wall around the children for the last half century, this kind of zone of privacy. And I can certainly understand that, but in terms of understanding the presidents and understanding the people who have led our country, obviously there are a lot of things I'd like to know.
People want to know about the current, more recent presidents. They want to know about Bill Clinton.
Right.
Which I don't know if anyone had a specific request, but you didn't go into too much detail
right.
about that.
Yeah, Bill Clinton, I argue that he's also a preoccupied dad. He and Hillary were very ambitious mm-hmm. and you know and preoccupied parents. It's not that they don't love their kids, but their focus is on building their career, and it just doesn't leave time. Bill Clinton used to read Chelsea. He didn't have time to read Chelsea books when he was home because he wasn't home that much. But whenever he would have her ride in his limousine with her, and that was story time, you know, in between meetings. So he tried to work it in, but he was really racing around because again he becomes president very young, and he's extremely ambitious at a young age.
And do you think parenting styles or how the public perceives presidential parenting styles will change if there is a woman in the White House as the first woman,
yes,
as opposed to first lady?
I think what's interesting is that Hillary Clinton's parenting style is almost more masculine than Barack Obama's. It was often said of Bill Clinton that he was America's first black president because he had a natural rapport with black people. And I think on some level, Barack Obama is almost our first woman president, because his style is very nurturing. And Hillary Clinton, I think for women of her generation that wanted to make it in a very competitive field, they almost had to be more male than the men. So her style is not particularly nurturing. So even though we have a first mom in the White House, she's more like the other presidents than the last president, Obama.
Interesting. So we'll have to see what comes next. We have about 5 minutes left. So before I ask a last question, if it's okay with you, could we do a rapid fire? Can I just mention
sure.
the president's names
sure.
and you can say perhaps the first thing that comes to mind?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to pull out my presidential list here because your historical knowledge exceeds mine. But we'll start with some of the more famous presidents.
Right.
Lincoln.
Lincoln is... Lincoln, so I have my six buckets, but Lincoln is kind of a different dad for different children. So for Robert, as I was saying, he rarely sees Robert. He's kind of a preoccupied dad. Robert said that during the Civil War, when he came back from Harvard, he never spent more than 10 minutes talking with his father. But then with Tad, but with his other sons, Willie and Tad, he spends a lot more time. And then he's also grief-stricken, as I've talked about, with Willie. And Willie was kind of his favorite son. But as I talked about, that loss shook him up, but it also kind of enabled him to reach deeper into himself to fight this horrible war in a very courageous way.
And two more presidents, very briefly, JFK and Reagan.
At JFK, we really don't have enough data on JFK because he died so young. And I have a sense that JFK was kind of a charmer, and there really isn't a lot of evidence about suggesting how exactly he interacted. But again, his presidency was so stressful with the Cuban Missile Crisis. Mm-hmm. You just get a sense that he would also qualify as a preoccupied dad, and that but then I do get a sense that with the loss of Patrick, that he may well have changed, because he toward the end of his life he seemed to feel a renewed commitment to his wife and his family, and again he dies so young it's really hard to tell.
And what about Reagan?
Yeah, Reagan, as I was saying earlier, there's a disconnect between the public and the private, that he was kind of a nurturing father of the country, but a distant father with his own children. And when Patty was young, Patty was like 2.5 years old, he writes her a 7-paragraph letter, and Patty can't read yet. And then he says, at the end of the letter, he says, and take care of mommy. And it just has a sense that he really wasn't taking Patty in. And that, again, his relationship was so close to Nancy, it didn't really leave much room for the children.
And in the spirit of Father's Day, which is coming up, I would like to know, this is our last question of the evening. In the honor of Father's Day, what would be your takeaway message for those dads in our audience and for those dads that are listening to our broadcast?
That fathering is always messy, that there are no perfect fathers, and it's always kind of a work in progress. And I hope this book will help people think about just how complicated it is. And it's just, it's very rewarding, but it's being president is hard, but being father is pretty hard too.
So it gives us some perspective for those of us as parents who feel overwhelmed with our daily lives. We can read this book and get a little perspective on what it's like to balance and juggle.
And every father and most American fathers can realize that they were better than John Adams.
Excellent closing words for our program tonight. So I hope you enjoyed this evening's program brought to you by the Oshman Family JCC and the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Joshua Kendall, author of First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and web. And with that, our meeting is formally adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.